Hey, everybody. This is another episode of the Welcome To podcast. I'm your host, Zach Vega. Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. We're a nonprofit based out of beautiful Traverse City, Michigan, specializing in projects that help communities to improve on their sustainability. And we've been working around the state since 1993. If you want to follow the Welcome To podcast, follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or however you listen to your podcasts. And be sure to check us out at liaa.org. I'm really excited about today's episode with Coleman Yoakum from Micah 6 Community in Pontiac. I've known about Coleman's work for a while now, and I was really excited to get the chance to go down to Pontiac and walk around the neighborhood that he and his team have really changed for the better over the past years. And Coleman was nice enough to welcome me into his house to record this episode, and I really hope you guys enjoy it, and I hope it inspires you to do great work in your communities. And I'm really excited to talk to you because I learned about Micah 6 about 2 years ago when I was working on a study at MSU.
And did we do all of our talk over email? Or did you call? I don't think you came out.
I think we had a phone conversation, I believe.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and I remember I was reading news articles about Micah 6 before calling you, and it was like the exact type of projects that I hopefully will be able to work on in Saginaw someday.
Okay.
But it's really kind of a pipe dream for me right now because it seems like you have to dedicate your whole life to it. And from what I read, you've really dedicated your entire life to it.
This is my full-time job. Yeah.
Right, right.
And much more than that. Like one of my board members made me, I don't think that she wasn't trusting me, but she made me track my hours to make sure that I was getting 40 hours a week.
Like, I'm at 200.
And I said, here you go. And she never asked me to do that again. So I think she believes me now.
And can you tell everyone, so I'm decently familiar with Micah 6, and you were nice enough to take me around your neighborhood in Pontiac to show me some of the work that you guys are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell people what Micah 6 is and how it started?
Yeah, so I'm not from here. I grew up in Arkansas. That's home. And several friends and I, while we were in college together, started doing some neighborhood work in a little low-income housing development not far from where we were going to school. And it started with just kind of showing up with a soccer ball and kicking a ball around. And then, like, here came a kid and another kid and another kid. And we said, well, that was fun. Like, let's just do that again next week. And so we ended up doing it week after week. And then eventually, the moms in the neighborhood start going, where do all my kids go at 7 o'clock every Thursday? And they came out and we met them. And we had a group of girls who were hanging out with us. And then they started organizing babysitting nights. And kind of meeting all at one apartment, and all the kids would get dropped off and the moms would go grocery shopping or go out on a date or go see a movie or sometimes just go back home and have like a little bit of quiet because single moms don't get that a whole lot. Then we came up on some holidays. We said we should do something fun for holidays. And so we organized a trunk or treat in a neighborhood where people said, people don't trick or treat in this neighborhood. And so we said people should. And so we started organizing that. And then we came up on Easter one year, and we had a group of friends who were having a competition amongst themselves to see who could get away the longest with raising barnyard animals in their dorm rooms. And so we snuck all those animals out and took them to our neighborhood. And for Easter, we had a petting zoo that completely came out of our dorm with like rabbits and ducks, and somebody had chickens and somebody else had a goat. And so we snuck all those out and had a petting zoo in the neighborhood. And then we helped several of our families apply for Habitat homes. Several of them got approved. And then we helped them put in the sweat equity hours on their Habitat homes. And at the end of all of that, as we were coming up on graduating, we're just like, let's go somewhere and do this for real. That, just a couple of years that we were doing it while we were in school, a couple of days a week, we saw the real impact that it had on just morale in that community and identity and the appreciation that they had and the knowledge, of their neighbors. And so we said we wanted to go somewhere and do this with our lives, basically. And we had a lot of conversations about where that was going to be. We looked at Charlotte and St. Louis and Dallas and Houston and London, Ontario, and ultimately couldn't decide. And so I get very impatient. And so I just told everybody, I'm going to move to Detroit. And everyone said, okay, great, you first. And so I sold everything that didn't fit in my car, and I drove to Michigan, and rented an attic at Chicago in the Lodge down in Detroit, and then just started working with a couple of groups down there who are really investing not in the city initiative or even a regional initiative, but they're like working on like 4 to 5 blocks and really just trying to make life better there. And so it was kind of with that idea that I started getting plugged into things out in Pontiac and moved here in 2012. We bought our house August of 2012, and I called all my friends and said, I bought a house, move up here. And so 2012 was a pretty rough time for recent college graduates. I had friends with accounting degrees who were baristas and friends with communications degrees who were pushing carts at Walmart. And so they were all kind enough and excited enough about what we were doing to quit what they were doing and move here and start this with me. And we took the first year of our time here, we said, we're not starting anything. We're not doing any initiatives. We're not trying to get something up and going. We're not building any programs. We're just going to sit around and ask a lot of questions and get to know our neighbors. And so our first neighbor friend was a guy named Berto, and we just kind of got to ask the questions, you know, through friendship, you know, like, what's going well here? What's not going well? Where do your kids go to school? How is that? Why do people move here? Why do people leave? And so we, through asking this to, you know, probably 100 different people in our community, we sort of really started zeroing in on the things that we thought we could be really good at addressing. And one of those was food. And, you know, my neighborhood is the quintessential food desert where we have, you know, gas station, liquor store, and a thrift store that sells food. All within walking distance of the people in my community, but the nearest grocery store that actually sells fresh produce is 1.5 miles away. 47% of my neighbors don't have cars, and so if you decide to hoof it and actually try and walk to the grocery store with your walker, with your cane, whatever disability you have, and you get there and you have to decide what you want to try to carry back, a bag of apples or a bag of chips. If you decide to make the apples decision or buy the produce, then you are, I'm going to get that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So you decide to buy the bag of chips or the bag of apples. If you decide to make the healthy decision and start walking back with produce, it's heavy and your bags tear. And a lot of my neighbors are already on fixed food budgets, and then they're leaving food on the sidewalk between the grocery store and their house when their bags rip. And so, but we have all these vacant lots around our community. So the city of Pontiac has knocked down 1,200 homes in the past 3 years. All of our CDBG dollars right now are going toward that. And so we said, well, what if we started growing gardens? And we floated the idea to our neighborhood, and they were very excited about it. Then we sort of pitched it to a little bit wider, which I can tell you that story later. That was kind of a disaster. But we went to the county and asked to buy a vacant lot and asked how much they were, and they said they were $10. And that was pretty mind-blowing to me, and so we bought 8 of them all around our community, so all within about 2 blocks of each other, and then started enlisting the help of a lot of the neighbors who were really excited about getting gardens going to actually help us grow these things. And so from there, we started, our first year we grew 500 pounds, and this past year we grew 7,000. We have now opened a vegetable store in our neighborhood. We've created 4 jobs with that vegetable store on our farm operations, and then that's kind of segued us into a lot of the other things that we did, but we started with food.
And how did you decide on the neighborhood? Was that random, or did someone tell you, you know, this neighborhood has a lot of potential, it just needs the right person to...
No, we never talked about things like potential. My background's in sociology, social work, I was looking for, in particular, a neighborhood that had high crime, high foreclosures, and high unemployment.
What most people look for when
that's what I always say, because I like to make my mom cry. but we, you know, looked at a couple houses in different parts of the neighborhood. We looked at, or in the city, we looked on the east side. We looked at a house on Marshall. We looked at a street off of Kennett. And then we also looked at a house on Newberry, which is where we ended up. But, in 2012, if you're a real estate agent in Pontiac, your job is polishing turds. Mm-hmm. Like, the market was not great. And so, you know, my poor real estate agent is walking us around, and like her cut is going to be incredibly small because these houses are so cheap. And so, you know, she's pointing at, you know, she's like, well, I think that this house is livable because somebody might be living here. And I hope you like cats. This house seems to come with cats. And that hole in the ceiling could be a very attractive skylight. And so, like, this is just what it was like. And so we were looking at our house on Newberry. And as we were looking at it, a guy walked in the house behind us. His name was Warren Rogers. And he said, hey, your real estate agent isn't going to tell you this, but you need to know that somebody got raped on this porch a couple weeks ago. And that's the kind of neighborhood you're in right now.
Wow.
And my real estate agent was, you know, she said, well, there goes my sale. And my cute little girlfriend at the time was like, get me out of here. Mm-hmm. And I said, perfect. Like, this yeah. is the place that we need to be. Like, this is where we're going. And this is the kind of stuff that we want to do. And we like the kind of environment that we want to be in to try to make a difference. And so that was kind of the moment for me where I said, this is the house that we should buy and we should move into. And so we closed on August 1st of 2012. And I called all my friends, and most of them were here and moved in by the end of August.
So you started this with your friends, and so you and a bunch of people from out of state, your mm-hmm. friends, you move here, and you said you spent really the first year listening.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take for neighbors to be open to, I guess, your initiative, your vision for what could be?
So we started meeting people right away. I mean, we were already demographically different. We were all, you know, college-educated white kids moving into this. And we found out later that sort of the assumption was that it was predominantly black, but it was actually about a third, black, white, Hispanic.
Okay.
And so, but as we were renovating, housing and affordable housing is such a premium around here. And people are moving so much, and that the neighborhood was so transient that as we were moving in and we started fixing up our house, people would walk in every day and say, when are you going to rent this place out? And we'd say, oh, well, we're not renting it out. We're going to live here. And they would sort of roll their eyes or say, good luck, or something like that. And I would say, come on in, you know, like, tell me why you feel that way or why you don't think that. And so we just met a lot of people and got to ask a lot of questions. Our first friend, Berto, so when we moved in the house, we realized that all the plumbing had been stolen and scrapped out. And so we said, okay, that's interesting. So it was like me and YouTube, we're going to replumb this whole house. And then a lot of questions to the guy at Home Depot. And so I'm carrying all this stuff into my house, and Berto is sitting on the porch next door, and he says, what are you doing? And I said, oh, somebody stole our plumbing, so I have to replace it. And he goes, oh, yeah, I did that. And I was like, oh, cool.
Can I have it back?
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to help me put it back? And he said, sure. And
wow.
So, like, Berto and I, like, Berto was my first friend in the neighborhood, and I just got to ask, you know, and hang out with him and get to know about him and his family and what's going on and how long he's been in his house. And, you know, he's got all family all around the city. And so I got to learn a lot about that. And I would say, like, I learned a lot from him. He really sucked at plumbing. He was not good at
taking it out.
As I say, more of a removal artist than an install guy. But he, you know, he was our first friend, and then we met him, and then he introduced us to his sister, and then his cousin, and then all these other people, and then...
And they're all in the neighborhood?
Yeah, they're all right around here. And then the other thing that I was really pretty adamant about for our team was, if you've got nothing going on, rather than go sit in your room and read a book or watch TV or whatever, go sit on the porch. Like, read a book, wave at everybody that drives by. We're at this perfect place. We're at the end of a T in our street. And so everybody in the neighborhood, if you're going to your house, you drive past my house. And so I was pretty adamant about it. Just be out there and wave at people and say hello to anybody who walks by or rides their bike by. And so there was one time, probably about 6 months after we had moved in, I was outside and I saw somebody and waved. This was, you know, at this point now in February. And the person stops their car and says, I've heard about you guys. And I said, you've heard about us? And this is before we even started doing anything. He said, I've heard about you guys. You guys are the white kids that wave at everybody. And I was like, Okay, great. Yeah, if that's the reputation, then that's awesome. That means we're doing our job. We're being hospitable. We're getting to know our neighbors, and that was really like a really affirming moment for us. But it didn't take long for us to get to know most of our neighbors, and then we started figuring out that our neighborhood's pretty transient. That average stay in our neighborhood at that point was every 5 months. They were moving out. And so
is it mostly rental properties here?
So our neighborhood is 78% rentals.
Okay.
And so, you know, we moved in August, October, November, it gets cold. Everyone goes inside. By the time everybody comes back out in April, we're some of the oldest neighbors in the neighborhood.
Wow.
And then, you know, at 2 years, we were the oldest. Like, we'd been here longer than anyone else. And then we started seeing this thing where people leave and then come back. And so, you know, they went, they left their apartment here, went and rented on another side of town, had an issue over there, and then a year later moved back into the neighborhood. And so we've seen a good amount of that now. And so a big part of that is crime, is that, like, when you're anonymous and the neighborhood's anonymous, you can't prevent crime, you can't report crime. So my friend and I were sitting on my front porch one day, and we watched a guy walk out of an apartment building, a big apartment building in the neighborhood, the one you really liked, called Monroe Manor. That guy walked out, walked over to a homeless guy, punched him, saw a van that had a six-pack of Natty Daddies or something sitting in the front seat. He got his fingers in the door and jacked it open and stole all the beer out of the front seat. And it was like, I don't know that guy, I don't know whose car that was, and I don't know that homeless guy. So I don't even know how to report any of this as a crime.
Right.
And so when that's the case, you get away with a lot. And yeah. So petty crime and stupid crime was so high in our neighborhood when we started. And then as we started doing neighborhood events and introducing people to each other, that petty crime really started to go down.
Right. You're not going to steal from your friends.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Or not even friends, just that guy who now knows you down the hall. You know, that
you
kind
to
of
let
thing.
Her in that she locked out. All right.
Your podcast is going to have
a lot of editing,
exciting
lot
color editing, yeah. to it. This is what Coleman's
what's going on
like.
Right now?
They're going up the stairs. So I was like, what is that sound?
Okay. Yeah, well, speaking of the transient population, I think you, I don't know if I've read this mm-hmm. or you told me on the phone when we talked a couple of years ago that you were allowing homeless people into your home.
Yes, so
that was the one that really okay. I was like, okay, this guy,
we've knocked down 1,200 homes in the past 3 years. Before mm-hmm. that, we just had a lot of vacant houses sitting around here. And so we had a lot of friends that we meet in the neighborhood, get to know, who were squatting in these vacant houses that didn't have heat or electricity or water. But it was a roof over their head, which was something, right? And so as we started kind of trying to figure out what some things were that we could do in our neighborhood, we said, you know, we have a lot of friends in the houses around here who aren't taking showers, who don't have a place to cook food, who don't have a place even to charge their phones. And so if they have a caseworker who's working on their housing who tries to give them a call, you know, they aren't able to get it. Or, you know, they don't have an address. Like, you know, our friend Red, his name is Chris, but he goes by Red, in the neighborhood. He says, you know, I'm trying to get my housing, but I don't want to write down my abandoned house that I'm staying in as my address. And so we started letting a lot of people use our house as their address to get things mailed to them. And so we, you know, we just sort of started saying, like, what if we just kind of left our door open? And as people needed, they could come in, cook food, take showers, do laundry, that sort of thing. And so for the first couple of years of Micah 6, if you just showed up at my house, there's probably half a dozen homeless people who are just lounging around our living room, taking showers, cooking food. And this was really hard for even some of them to wrap their minds around. Sometime we had a guy named Sheik who came in, and he sat down. We were talking, and Tanya, who was there, she had made a bowl of soup and had carried it into the living room and sat down. And she goes, "Cole, did you know that she just made food at your house?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Is that cool?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "You're just going to let her do that?" I said, "Anybody can make food." And he just goes, "Man." And he walks out the door. And that was not an unusual interaction. Like, that was fine. And so I'm sitting there kind of working on some stuff, talking to Tanya. And I hear down the street yelling, which is also not super unusual. Mm-hmm. But as it gets closer, he goes, "I'm going to Cole's house. Uh-oh. He said we could cook food. Cole, the white guy at the end of the..." And I'm just like, what is going on? And look at, and she had walked down to the gas station and bought a stack of the boxes of ramen noodles that he, like, couldn't see where he was going. He's, like, yelling out both sides of the stack of ramen noodles. And he had a stash of ramen noodles at his house that he cooked every day for the next, you know, 6 months or whatever. And then he would replenish it. And that was just kind of how our house ran. One of my favorite stories from when we started was it was Christmas Eve of 2012. And I was coming home and it was snowing outside, and there was a woman walking in front of my house, bigger woman in wedge heels and booty shorts and a tank top. And I said, "Where are you going? What's going on?" Like, and she said, "Oh, well," her and her boyfriend had been staying at Hope Warming Center. And the night before, her boyfriend had gotten, like, I think found $20 or something like that. And so, there's a pretty common currency in my neighborhood where, if you can buy alcohol, you will not sleep on the street, because someone will go, "Oh yeah, you've got beer, come on in," or "You've got, you know, a bottle of vodka or whatever, come on in, and we'll split it and you can stay here." And so they did not go to the Warming Center that night. Instead, they went to a friend's house and drank all night. And then she woke up in the morning and her boyfriend was gone, and the guy whose house it was telling her she had to leave. And so she was just kind of walking around to the different places that her boyfriend might be, trying to track him down. And I said, "Well, you know, I'll take you back to the Warming Center tonight. Do you want to go to Meijer and get some warm clothes?" And so we went and bought some sweatpants and shoes and a hoodie and some new shoes for her, and came back. And so we sat down in my living room, because it was still a couple of hours before the Warming Center opened. And she said, "Can I take a shower? I haven't taken a shower in 4 days." And I said, "Absolutely, take a shower." And so she went upstairs to take a shower. I jumped on Skype with my friend Frank, and we were talking. And I hear the door open upstairs. I'm going, what's going on? And then I see someone coming down the stairs. And she comes down the stairs head to toe, butt naked, with her clothes that she had been wearing in her hand. She goes, "Can we wash these?" And, like, Frank, who's on my camera in front of me, is going, "Coleman,
what's going on?
Yeah. Looks like you saw a ghost." And I'm like, shut up. So, like, that sort of stuff happened at my house all the time. We had a group of homeless folks who loved The Walking Dead. And okay. So, you know, like, every – was it Tuesday night or Sunday night was dead night at my house, or everybody would show up to watch The Walking Dead, and it's us and our homeless friends freaking out about zombies and stuff like that all night long. And so – yeah, that was the first couple of years of Micah 6. That has changed since we demolished all these houses. My friends don't have places to stay anymore. And so it has sort of switched to when any one of them gets a housing voucher, you know, which has stipulations, you have to live by yourself, blah, blah, blah. 8 people move in with that guy. And yeah. So, you know, now they're living 8 or 9 deep.
Yeah, we even saw the same thing in Lansing, the unit I was living in there. It's pretty common.
Yeah, 8 or 9 people deep in a small apartment, and just, you know, which is more violent, and people get their stuff stolen more often and things like that. But They have a place to shower, and they have a place to cook food. And so sort of that thing that we were doing in the beginning sort of outlived its usefulness in how things have gone here.
So at that time, it was who was all living here from your team? So how big is your team?
We'll say that was 2014. Then it was me and Dylan. And then there was Sean, our friend Nathan, and our friend Blake. So there were probably 5 or 6 of us.
Okay. And I'm hoping that these stories and your work is inspiration for other people to start up similar initiatives, because there's a lot of cities in Michigan that need this type of work and just neighborhoods in general. How did you start? How did you get your funding? Where did you guys start looking? How did you?
So Michigan, not Michigan, but Pontiac in particular. One of the places that we had looked at and considered doing this was in Oakland, California. And this was kind of pre a lot of the gentrification and things that have happened out there. But even like, you know, a sagging, dilapidated, falling down house is still $150,000 in Oakland. Compared to, you know, we bought our house,
which, $10 lot.
Right. So we bought our house, which is a 6-bedroom, 3,200 square foot duplex that we knocked the wall out of the middle and made it one big house. We paid $9,000 for that. So in terms of what we had to spend to get up and going, it was pretty minimal. Our background in our college was a Bible college, and so we had connections to churches and things like that. We were from all over the country, so we had places to go back and people that we knew who would be interested in supporting what we were doing, and so we did that. But, I mean, I think our total budget for our first year was like $25,000, and $9,000 of that was the house, and another $5,000 of it was just to get it livable. And we've kind of grown incrementally since then. I think our budget last year was $250,000, and that's mostly coming from, individual donors, churches that like what we're doing, that kind of thing. And then last year was the first year we kind of got really good at grants, so we got about $40,000 in grants last year. But yeah, for the most part, it's still individuals who are giving, on average, $100 a month.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was wondering is, like, did you guys just get a grant up front? But it was really just grassroots friends, people you knew who just believed in what you were doing. And
grinding it out, yeah. And we all have other jobs. And so, I mean, we're all doing other stuff. So even I, like, this is my full-time job now, but I make $15,000 a year. And to supplement that, I do some work on political campaigns and things like that in the area. But Dylan is a youth minister, and Carrie is the director of admissions at the Michigan School for Professional Psychology, and Bethany, my wife, works at a restaurant, and Emma works with kids who have autism, and so we all have, like, whole other jobs that we're doing on top of the things that we do here.
And then after you're exhausted from that, instead of getting home and popping on the Netflix, you guys go, okay, let's like, take one of the worst neighborhoods and, high crime, high everything, and make it better. It's so much energy. How that must have been really stressful starting out, right?
I mean, I think I just didn't know any better. Yeah. I mean, how old are you?
24.
There you go. I was 24 when I started. It's like, I didn't know. Like, sure. It's just that. And everything else was kind of the stuff I was doing in my other time. This was my passion project. It's what I wanted to do. It's what I'd always imagined doing. And I tell people all the time that there are probably more hard days than easy days here, that everything that comes to you is a crisis. I'm about to get evicted. My boyfriend just punched me. I don't know where my son is, or my mom's passed out, or this person has overdosed on my porch. I need your help. Like, that stuff, I mean, and it never stops. Like, last year, somebody drove to our school, the school building that we own in our neighborhood, parked behind the building, poured gas all over themselves, and set their car on fire.
Wow.
Like, yeah, I did not wake up expecting to need the bandwidth to deal with that. So it never stops. I would have quit a long, long time ago had my best friends not come to do this with me. I mean, and we've sort of outgrown it now. We all got married, and weirdly enough, my wife doesn't want to live with my best friends. but, like, that on really hard days, like, my best friend Dylan lived 10 feet away from me.
Yeah.
And I could walk down the hall and go, hey, today really sucked. And he's like, yeah, me too. And we got to do that together. And that there was, when your team gets to a good enough size, there's a certain amount of handoff ability where I am at the end of my rope today with Charity. She has just worn me out. Sorry, Charity, a person, not Charity. Charity.
I'm done with Charity.
Right. Yeah, I'm done. but Charity, our neighbor, who, I said, I'm done. I'm burnt out. I think if I spend 10 more minutes with her, I'll probably yell at her. Dylan, can we do this handoff? And or Brianna or Bethany or whoever is on the team at the time, like, can you go do this one now? I can't take one more. And so a team is absolutely essential, and that I got to do it with my best friends has made the world a difference. It's the only reason we're still here.
And has that team stayed consistent? Or
No.
I imagine some people. It seems like it's just so. I don't know how it could be possible that at least one person wasn't overwhelmed by all this.
Right. So we talk about this a lot, like Saturday Night Live. That there are some people who will come in for a couple of seasons. Some people here are here for 10 seasons. Some people you only see on one or two episodes and they're gone. I am Lauren Michaels. I will be here forever. Over the past 7 years, we've had probably on the team 17 people. The most we've ever had at once is 9. We've found some pretty... at this point now, we can sort of watch a person's trajectory when they come in, like super excited, pumped, ready to go. Then like two or three things happen that really kind of kill their momentum, and then they sort of taper off after that. And then, you know, then it's up to us how it ends. But we've seen that pattern enough now from people who, you know, come in and give what they can in the time that they can and the time that they have. And then they move on to the next thing. And, you know, they don't stop contributing, and this wasn't just a thing they did for a while. I think that this sort of work changes people and sort of affects how you see your neighborhood forever and the things that you can do in it for a long time. And so okay.
And are these people, I know you said you started with your friends, but the people who have come on since then, are those also your friends or just people who heard about you, got in contact? Are they from the neighborhood?
Let me think about this. So our first ones, so it was me, Blake, Kim, and Dylan. So we all went to college together down in Arkansas. They're from all over the place, but they moved here to do this. Kim cycled off after a year. It was too stressful for her. Blake left after a year and a half. We added in Nathan, who was a friend of Dylan's from Canada. Then Sean was just like a random dude who went to a church who heard about this and said, oh, that sounds fun. He was engaged at the time and said, that sounds like a fun thing to do for this year before I get married.
A fun thing to do.
He was awesome. And then actually, instead of moving out when he got married, Brianna moved here to join the team. And so we, at that point, had purchased a second house because our team had grown enough. And so we bought the house next door, and they lived next door. They were here for another year and a half after that, and then they had to move downriver for grad school. So they moved out, but we still see them fairly often. Josh and Susanna moved here. They were like doing mission work in Japan and then came back and lived here for a year. Sarah is Josh's sister. She came with him. And then we just kind of had our first round of like second generation additions that we didn't know from college or weren't sort of attached to any of us. So Emma, who runs our kids programs here, she's been here for a year and a half.
I was going to ask what everyone does, like mm-hmm. what are your day-to-day projects? Because I want to talk in a minute about the larger projects, mm-hmm. like the school and the lots and what you guys are doing with that. But what's like the day-to-day programming? Mm-hmm.
So Emma runs all of our kids stuff. Hayden, we just added back in June. He's kind of our team social worker. That was his background. And then he worked for Community Housing Network for a while. And so he kind of understands kind of the intricacies of housing and getting people into housing, that kind of thing. Then we've got Christian, who was a pickup, who just kind of heard about us, was excited, came and joined the team for 2 years and ran our gardens for 2 years. So, but he just cycled off to kind of figure out what his next thing was. So everybody's job. So I'm the executive director, which I always tell people sounds really glamorous. It sounds like you're the guy in charge, but really you are the guy that gets all the leftovers. Like when someone breaks a window on one of our houses and we go, oh, who has to sit and wait for the window guy to show up? Oh, that's me. That's that. And they're, you know, of course their window is like, we'll be there between 2 and 10. And so I just have to sit there for, you know, 8 hours and wait for them to show up at 10:15. So that's what I do. I do most of the grant writing. I do all the traveling and fundraising and talking about this. Then we have Carrie. Carrie runs all of our finances. So she is the person who makes sure that we're not spending too much money and that we spend our grants the way we should and things like that. Dylan does most of our neighbor care, and part of that was helping like an AA meeting get up and going, and then getting a church up and going for a lot of our neighbors who had been asked not to come back to church or for whatever reason couldn't go to a church. And so he does that. Emma runs all of our kids programming. Hayden's our social worker. Bethany, my wife, does Sprout, which is all of our produce, the retail side of all of our produce. So organizes all the pop-ups that we do around the city. She runs Sprout, that kind of thing. Who did I miss? Bethany? Nope, that's everyone.
And is this all neighborhood-centric, or do you guys have a larger reach to other neighborhoods, or is it mostly...
Some of the stuff we do... So when we started getting in so much food, so we grew 7,000 pounds, we became, you know, picked up a lot of partner farms who started donating a lot of produce to us, you know... We had way too much for our neighborhood, more than our neighborhood wanted, more than our neighborhood needed. And so Bethany started organizing what we call pop-ups, which is where we go set up a farm stand in, you know, any of the other neighborhoods in Pontiac that have access issues. And so she sets up a stand at Ulsa, which is our Head Start location. She sets up at Community Housing Network. She has two locations at each of our senior citizen centers. We're doing pop-ups at a couple of our hospitals. And so those are in other neighborhoods, but it's really just an outlet, a retail outlet for all of our produce. But yeah, this is, we really define our neighborhood and the scope of where we want to work about 6 blocks wide by about 3 blocks tall.
And how many people?
About 3,000.
About 3,000.
Yep.
Okay. So yeah, can you talk a little bit about when you moved here and you saw that there were these vacant lots, and then I'm really interested in the school project, because when you say, you know, we bought a vacant school, most people are like, that sounds crazy. Why did you do that?
And it is. It was really silly. So we currently right now own about 10 vacant lots around the neighborhood. So some of those are gardens that are actually growing produce. Some of those are flowers and just more community spaces where we're putting concrete pads and picnic tables and growing flowers, and it's just a pretty place to hang out in the neighborhood. And some of those are straight fruit trees. So we have about 150 fruit trees around the neighborhood that we tend and planted and maintain. And this year actually got to pick some stuff off of them, which was really great. The biggest piece of vacant property in our neighborhood for the longest time was a vacant elementary school, literally right across the street from our house. So Webster Elementary School, it sits on M59, 27,000 cars a day drive past it. It sits on 5 acres. And so we had always looked at it. And early on, just for kicks and giggles, we inquired from the school district how much it would cost to buy it. And they told us $1 million.
So, an even number.
Right, yeah. And we said, okay, well, that's neat. Then kind of as Pontiac Schools hit some financial issues, the state superintendent said, you have to sell all your vacant buildings. At that point, we were holding on to them because we didn't want them turned into charter schools or anything like that. And so when that order came down, a guy named Michael Stevens bought 8 buildings for about $2 million. And so we had been doing, sort of without permission, a lot of stuff on that playground. We have neighborhood barbecues out there. We play soccer with kids every Thursday. We have our big back-to-school event out there the first week of every August. And so we went to Michael after he bought it, and I didn't know him, just called him and said, hey, you know, we are doing this project. We're right behind your building. We've been using the playground for a lot. Can we, you know, keep using it for that? And so through that, Michael and I became friends and started hanging out and talking, and he started coming to a lot of the things that we do. And at the end of that, he asked, you know, let's come to a number that we can both agree on to sell you that building for. I didn't want the building. I said, well, what if we just took the playground? Like, that's what we're really using, is the playground for programming and things like that, and all of our events. And he said, no, because if that building ever gets redeveloped, it's going to need parking. And the parking probably is going to have to come out of the playground. And we're like, oh, okay. And so we kind of hemmed and hawed and came to an agreement on $200,000. We bought it on a land contract, so we had a mortgage on that building. We immediately built up a big garden on that playground. We have 2 hoop houses now, about 20 raised beds. We're growing hops. We've got 40 trees out there. And then we're using the other half of it still for soccer and outdoor events and things like that out there. And so the dream, ultimately, now is there's so much to do in our neighborhood. And a lot of what I think runs people ragged in my neighborhood and on my team is that we keep trying to address all of the problems. That eventually, you know, somebody on our team hears somebody enough say, I need a ride to the doctor, I need a ride to the doctor, that we start sort of trying to organize transportation. Mm-hmm. Or the kids have nothing to do, the kids have nothing to do, that we start trying to organize kids programming. Or, you know, all of these things, right? And so we said, and we will do this thing where we ramp up what we're doing and burn someone out, and then we kind of taper it off again, and then we burn someone out, taper it off again. And so we said, okay, what if we renovated this building? And instead of us doing it or us using it or whatever, we just found other organizations in the city who are doing amazing work and let them move into that building so that they can provide services to the people in our community rather than us have to do it. You know, there's a transportation company that's doing this kind of work in our city. Let's move them here. There's somebody who's doing art programming for adults with mental and social disabilities. Why don't we move them here? There's somebody who's doing kids programming. Let's let them move in here. And so the idea is that we're renovating this building. We're moving in all these organizations who do great work so that they can keep doing that really great work in my neighborhood. And so right now we're at about 80% of our space committed. Groundbreaking happens in August of next year, and then we'll wrap up about August of the year after that. So August of 21 is what we're shooting for an opening date.
Great. It's a lot of work, but it's
a lot of work. Amazing. It's I learn new stuff every day. This project is a $14 million project. We're getting about half of that from different government sources and things like that, and then my fundraising load for foundations and things like that is about $5 million. And so it's a lot. I'm learning a lot. I'm meeting a lot of people who are doing similar projects and other exciting things. And I get to go visit the work that they do. And, you know, people all the time, I say, hey, well, here's what we're thinking about doing. And they'll go, no, don't do that. And they're like, not to step on your toes. And I'm like, no, please step on my toes. Like, I do not want to mess anything up. Right. Or if you've already made that mistake, I'd rather not do it. And so.
And where are you meeting these people? Or like, who do you call when you're like, okay, I have a school now and I want to put these great organizations in it. What do I do?
Right. And so, you know, for instance, you know, what happens a lot of time is that I'll tell somebody what we're doing and they'll go, oh, like blah, 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 blah. And I'll go, okay, I need to go look at that. Or, you know, somebody and we're two steps behind somebody in Kalamazoo who's doing a very similar thing. And he just shot me an email and said, hey, like, we're a little bit further down the road. If you ever want to come check out our project, come check out our project. And okay, great. And so, you know, we went and just toured this weekend. We went up to the Commons up in Traverse because it's mm-hmm. a similar, you know, it's a much huger project, obviously. But, you know, what's it look like to renovate an old building and then sort of rent it out to tenants and create sort of campus-wide programming where they sort of are all working together on different things? And, like, that's exciting to me, and that's kind of what we're looking at doing. And so, so it's just kind of you go wherever you hear something interesting is happening and try and steal some good ideas from them.
And then when we were walking around the neighborhood and you were showing me these projects, I was admiring, similar to how I admire a lot of the architecture in Saginaw and the old buildings. Your next project will be a really interesting apartment complex that we mm-hmm. were looking at.
So Mishta has not... So, you know, they have their funding mechanisms they use for housing and affordable housing and things like this. And part of it is that you don't want to put somebody in affordable housing who's already a vulnerable population in the middle of nowhere, right? Like, yeah. I understand that. I get it. We've had three housing developments recently in the past just couple of years. Go up for funding from Mishta for affordable housing and get shot down because their walkability score isn't great. But these are a school building tucked into a neighborhood and an apartment complex that used to exist, but now it's been dilapidated for about 10 years, and they gave it a pretty bad walking score because there's just not a whole lot of community assets nearby. Now that we have a giant community center right in the middle of our neighborhood, that's a pretty big deal in terms of an asset, especially when you consider that it will have a food hub as part of it. It'll have programming for kids. It'll have programming for older adults. That changes the game on the score that some of our projects are going to get in the city. And so directly across the street from our school building is a 34-unit apartment building that's been empty for about 15 years now. And it looks like it. And it's you know, the only way it's going to get renovated is, you know, with Mishta money and with Brownfield money and things like that, because it doesn't make sense. The only thing you're going to save money on is brick in this project. And so, and this is kind of our safeguard against the sort of unintended consequences that this community center is going to have in terms of gentrification, mm-hmm. that it is going to raise the property values of things around here and is going to raise the rates of rent around here. And so we have a lot of neighbors that we know and that we love and that we've invested in and that we really want to see stay in this neighborhood. And so as sort of a complement to our community center project, we'd also are going to seek to renovate that building in hopes of capturing a lot of our friends who are getting priced out of their apartments around here and letting them move in there and let that be an affordable option for them.
Yeah, the gentrification issue is an interesting one. Has that concern come up from any of the neighbors that, you know, it's great what you're doing here, Cole. You're giving our kids things to do. We've mm-hmm. got food. Are they at all worried about that, or is it right now just sort of they're enjoying what you're bringing?
We get accused often of being gentrifiers by people who don't come and see what we're doing, don't work what they're doing, don't know anybody in our neighborhood. That kind of thing happens from time to time, but you'll never find a person in our neighborhood that's complaining about what we're doing. You know, we have the voice and the momentum and the know-how to put pressure on our local officials to fix our potholes. That we're building this beautiful garden that people can wake up to and look out their window and see that it's providing food for that week at the end of the month where their bridge card is spent, that we're doing stuff with their kids. We're doing tutoring after school. We're doing summer programming that didn't exist here before. And so one of the things that has, I think, led to what some might call gentrification in my neighborhood is that in the beginning, turnover was every 5 months. People were moving in and out. Now that we've got all this stuff going on and it's going well, people are staying mm-hmm. and they want to stay longer. And so people who we call intimately involved with us, that's people that we see 3 times a week or more, all those people have been here now for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
That's if you're, great. If you're in that middle range.
That's how you
range,
build a sense of community right there.
Yeah. If you're in that middle range and you're seeing people a couple times a week or maybe once a week, those people are all been here for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Anybody who doesn't get involved with us is still moving around just as fast. And the stability that comes with knowing your neighbors, with people investing in their spaces, with people start cleaning up their yards or mowing their yards and things like that, because they're planning on being here for a while, that changes the neighborhood.
Right. I did my thesis on social capital in the built environment, and just all the literature that goes into how when you trust your neighbors and you can rely on them, how it reduces your costs, how it encourages you to take care of your property, mm-hmm. how it encourages you to be more involved in what's going on.
Yeah.
How drastically has that changed since you moved here? What was it at and where is it currently? And was it the kind of thing where nobody knew their neighbor and they didn't really talk to each other?
Absolutely.
I
mean,
I assume there were just no public spaces for them to even do that.
No, I mean, we talk about this a lot, is that when we moved in, there was literally nowhere within walking distance of my neighborhood for you to sit across the table from anyone. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you've got gas stations, liquor stores, that sort of thing. Even our fast food locations are pushed out. They're on Telegraph. They're not anywhere near here. So if you wanted to sit, even if you're eating fast food, you can't sit across the table from someone within walking distance of here. And so to build community spaces and put up picnic tables and have neighborhood barbecues where, and really for the first 3 years, we made it our mission to know every single person in this neighborhood so that when we did neighborhood events, we could say, oh, Tamika, do you know LaShawn? You guys both have three-year-old kids. You know, if you guys ever want to bring them to the garden and have a play date, you're more than welcome to do that. Or Daryl, you know, or this is, you know, Joe. Joe lives over here on Murphy Street. Joe used to work at a brake place and knows how to change brakes. And I know you've been having trouble with your brakes. Mm-hmm. So maybe you guys can link up. And if you need help paying for your brakes, let me know and I can pay for that. Like that we spent a lot of time connecting people to each other in our neighborhood. And so that sort of thing has really changed a lot. The people who are connected are way in and know each other a lot. I mean, crime is down 50% from the time we moved into now. We've seen that slow way, way down. And even, you know, Captain Ewing, who's our local police captain, is like, that neighborhood was gnarly when you guys moved in. And, you know, cops aren't here anymore. And kind of back to that gentrification idea, like the thing that we have seen price people out of the market more. So Monroe Manor, your favorite apartment building.
Yeah, it looks like a castle.
It looks like
a castle. If anyone's wondering why.
Like, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's an awesome building.
Put a picture in the show notes.
Okay.
It used to be owned by a guy named who was just a good old boy from White Lake, nicest guy in the world, but he hated housing vouchers. He says, I don't want anybody on housing vouchers. I'm going to keep my rent at a rate that working people can afford it. Like, I only want to hire people or, you know, let people move in here who have jobs. And I only want to let people. And because of that, he kept his rates at $400 a month. Mm-hmm. Is basically what he charged everybody in that building. And he wasn't making any money. I don't know that he was even clearing his bills. But when he got too old to do it anymore, he retired. He moved to Florida and sold the building to somebody who has a ton of other apartment buildings in the city. And almost, she turned around and rented it out almost exclusively to people on vouchers. And everybody on vouchers can pay $750 a month. And so she turned around and said, okay, to everybody in that building, at the end of your lease, at the end of this year, whatever your year is, you either have to move up to $750 or move out and make room for somebody else on vouchers.
People's rent, yeah.
And so, so my friend Pam, who works part-time at Arby's, who could afford $400, cannot take, you know, a $350 jump in her rent.
Right, and especially so, we just did a podcast yesterday with a professor at MSU who does housing, especially how low-income people acquire housing. And we were talking about how the voucher program, typically it's like one in five people who would qualify for it actually get it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if your rent's going up and the idea is, oh, now I have to get a housing voucher, there's not a high percentage chance that that's even going to happen. So.
Right, or that being homeless actually moves you to the front of the line.
Right.
And so we have people who,
so you're incentivizing
who
people.
Have yeah. apartments who then go and stay at Hope Warming Center, leave their apartment, go stay at the Warming Center for a month so they get bumped to the front of the line for housing. And so, but, you know, that kind of thing happens. And we've seen that really jack up people's rent around here is not any of the things that we're doing. It's landlords who see an area where they can profit from the housing voucher program that really had nothing to do with us.
Right. And that goes back to when you have someone who doesn't have a direct investment in the community.
Yeah, then, she lives in Florida.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty common. And that was the same when I was living in Lansing. You know, it was an apartment complex not owned by a local. You know, it's somebody with 100 buildings. Mm-hmm. They don't particularly care if people are coming in or out. They just want to have that monthly check coming in.
Yeah.
So I know you guys said that there used to be houses that were vacant here that you were allowed to kind of help people establish some just baseline shelter. Mm-hmm. Do you guys do anything with housing now besides that apartment complex you guys are going to be working on?
So we have – our initial house was a duplex that we – bought, knocked the wall out of the middle, made it one big house. And then our second house was a duplex. That one was an up and a down. Since this past year, like, we all got married, which makes, you know, changes everything. And so we've put the wall back up in the first one, rented out. The left side is somebody from the community. And then Emma lives on the bottom of the up and the down, so she who runs all of our kids' stuff. So she lives on the bottom, and then we rented out the top to somebody from our neighborhood. So about half of the doors that we have right now are rented out to people in the community.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What do you see going forward? What are I know you've got the school that you that's got to be a huge weight that you guys are going to finish up, and then that apartment complex. Do you see in the future eventually this neighborhood's just going to it's going to be exactly what you envisioned it as a nice stable place for people to live? Do you imagine yourself ever moving to a different neighborhood and kind of trying to replicate? That's a hard question to ask with all the all the work you put in.
So, right. I don't know. I mean, we're just kind of taking it day by day. People have asked us in the past if we would, you know, almost would we be interested in franchising Micah 6 and going and doing this mm-hmm. somewhere else. And I always tell them that, you know, if we end up somewhere else, it would look completely different. That what we started with was food, because that's what people got to us with first.
Yeah, you spent the first year just mm-hmm. listening. Yeah.
And that, you know, we might go to a different neighborhood and find out that it's kids, and that the route that that takes looks completely different. I'd rather see people look at what we did, go, okay, that's really interesting. I wonder what that is, that thing is for this neighborhood over here, and jump in and figure that out for different places around. I probably will go and do this again somewhere else. Much smarter. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I won't screw up nearly as many things as I did this time. I think that, and that, you know, that there are parts of it that you lose, right? That I can't just move into a house with four of my friends again. And, you know, that community part was super important. And that sort of the team aspect of just living together and doing it together was super important to what we look like now and what we ended up becoming. I feel like I'll move into another neighborhood somewhere else and I'll start doing it again, but it'll look much more professional than it does grassroots.
Right. So. And plus you've got so many friends here. I mean, I almost accused you of having paid actors out there when we were walking around the neighborhood because it was just like, hi, Mr. Coleman, we love you. Kids are hugging you. I mean, I can't imagine it'd be easy to leave here after the, not only how much work you put in, but how much people are appreciate what you're doing.
It is the best thing in the world to walk down your street and know everybody, and everybody knows you, and kids run out and hug you, and adults razz you about the Lions game today, and
this guy's a Chiefs fan, by the way.
Right, yeah.
We're recording this on September 29th, Chiefs-Lions. He's not. His popularity took a little bit of a hit today in the neighborhood.
That's okay. That's all right. It is almost like this weird, feels fake kind of Mr. Rogers life that I get to live, where I know every one of my neighbors and they know me, and you know that family there. You know, they have bonfires every Friday and Saturday night, and I go to some of those, and then they're all at the neighborhood barbecue, and their kids are at summer camp with us, and it's just that family is just like every other family in this neighborhood that we're so tight with and that we love and that we know so well. And it's super lucky. And the idea that you could go do this again somewhere else, I think feels impossible to me in a lot of ways, but we'll see. I don't know.
All right. So we're at about an hour. So I'll end it on this question. So if you're not going to be franchising Micah 6 mm-hmm. and it's going to be difficult for you to move away, I guess we're going to have to hope that there are going to be other people who are willing to do similar work in places like Flint and Saginaw mm-hmm. and other places that need this kind of dedication and grassroots efforts to make people's lives better. So if there's somebody out there who's thinking about doing this kind of work, what advice do you have for them? Are they getting into?
Yeah. Spend a lot of time with other people who are already doing it. I mean, know right now that you're not smart enough to have invented something, that somebody else is doing what you want to do. And that shouldn't be discouraging. That should be a relief because you get to go learn from them and see what they're doing. Get good mentors. I mean, Lisa Johannan for me at Central Detroit Christian is still a resource that I lean on a lot. They've been at it now for almost 30 years. And so to know that there's nothing I'm going to do or no mistake that I'm going to make that somebody else hasn't made already, like that's super encouraging. This comes at a cost. You know, that cute little girlfriend from house shopping, you know, she said, we broke up and it didn't work out because she said, I can't do this kind of work. Like, this is too hard. And it, you know, she said, you know, how long do you think you're going to be doing this? And I said, my whole life. And she goes, oh, do you think you can do that work there and still live in like Rochester? And I said, no. And so it doesn't work, and that you lose friends, and that sometimes that's like something you don't even do or even contribute to, is just that your presence and your talking about the work that you do makes people feel judged, which I think is more on them than it is on you, but it's real. That, you know, Emma, who is on our team, is, you know, a lot of times prodded by her family, like, when are you going to quit? Or when are you going to come home and do this? Or like, wouldn't it be more responsible to, I mean, you get that question all the time. I get that question. Wouldn't it be more responsible to like go to grad school?
That's crazy. It's like the most responsible thing I've ever heard.
You know, it's just, so those things, come up a lot that it assaults, I think, a lot of the things you have in your brain, like makes you question a lot of things that you thought you really liked. And it's harder than just the day-to-day that, yeah, your mom calls and says, when are you coming home? Or, you know, that, no, I mean, I lived here for 5 years before my mom came to visit. She's like, I have no desire to go there.
Really? 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And it was really great. And so this is a really funny story. So she had a really great trip. I like met so many of my neighbors and had the best time and whatever. And the last day, I had to go clean up some trash on one of our lots that somebody had dumped a bunch of trash on. And I asked if she wanted to come, and she was like, well, I might head out. And I said, okay, that's fine too. And she goes, no, I'll come and help. And she picks up like a 5 gallon bucket that was in the trash and dumps out the water in it, and a gun falls out. And it's just like, whoa. Well, there it is. Like, yeah. That everyone was on their best behavior until that happened. And so, but yeah,
of course that happens on the last day.
Yeah. The last 20 minutes. Yeah. She's like, and I'm going home. Bring friends. If you got friends who will do it with you, that's huge. Fundraising is weird for something like this. I can't imagine how we would have done it if we didn't have sort of the faith background that we had. Like, we had so many people who loved us and encouraged us, and congregations and churches that really liked what we were doing. And so if you don't have that, like, I just don't know where your initial support comes from. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find employers who believe in what you're doing enough that it can affect your job. I got really lucky. I had a boss named Carrie Lozier who loved Micah 6 and loved what we were doing. And so knew when she was hiring me that this line's going to get blurry sometimes, that there's going to be a mom who I was watching a kid for who doesn't pick up her kid by 4 o'clock, and that's when I have to be at work, and so I'm bringing the kid to work, and gave me, so it was at a music studio, and she said, anytime you come across any kid who wants to learn how to play an instrument, just bring him in, and I'll find a slot for him. And she started doing programming with us at the Pontiac Public Library, which was super cool. And I mean, just as much as my friends, I don't think Micah 6 makes the turn in the road without a boss at a job who really believed in what we were doing and was flexible enough to let those lines blur from time to time. That was super important. I don't know. There's a lot. There's a lot there.
Well, thanks for doing all this work. And where can people find information about Micah 6?
We have a really bad website, Micah 6 with the number, community.com.
That's M-I-C-A-H.
A-H, yes. Yeah. So, and it's getting a reboot soon. But we're on Facebook. Instagram is like where you can see like the day-to-day stuff that's going on here. That's a lot of fun. But yeah, find us there.
All right, great. Well, thanks for taking the time, Cole, before your long trip away. I really appreciate it, and keep up the good work. It's amazing to watch and finally get to see in person.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, thanks.
Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. For more information about what we do, go to liaa.org. Music for this podcast was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Talk to you guys next time.